It's my great pleasure to introduce the closing keynotes. We're going to talk about complying with international commitments, innovative strategies for holding governments accountable. The Honorable Landon Pearson's longtime advocate for the rights and well-being of children. She's going to be our first speaker. She is former vice chairperson of the Canadian Commission for the International Year of the Child. She's president and chair of the Canadian Council on Children and Youth, chair of the Canadian Coalition for the Rights of Children. And after being appointed to the Canadian Senate in 1994, she served as advisor on children's rights to the Minister of Foreign Affairs. Upon her retirement from the Senate, she became the director of Carleton University's Landon Pearson Resource Center for the Study of Childhood and Children's Rights. I could go on, but I'm too anxious to hear from her. You can tell she has an extraordinary background on children. We're going to then go straight from her talk to hear from Roberto Bisio. He's worked as a journalist on development issues since 1975. He is executive director of the Instituto del Tercer Mundo, a nonprofit research and advocacy organization based in Uruguay. This institute encourages citizen involvement in global decision making through its numerous information, communication, and educational campaigns on development and environmental issues. He is in charge of the Social Watch Network's International Secretariat and edits the yearly Social Watch Report, which reflects the input of citizen coalitions in 70 countries. Social Watch monitors the implementation of national, regional, and international commitments to eradicate poverty. So again, I could go on at length about him, but we're going to hear such extraordinary things from them both about children in poverty that I'm going to pass it right over. Join me in welcoming them.
I'm really delighted to have been and feel privileged to have been part of this conference, from which I've learned a great many things, and particularly, as has been pointed out before, the variety of perspectives and experiences that have been shared here. And I am particularly delighted to see so many young people present, and I'll have some comments about more comments to you in a minute, you young people. To begin with, I'd like to invoke the privilege of age to preface my remarks about approaches which are innovative or otherwise to holding governments accountable for their human rights obligations by sharing three observations from my long life. The first concerns human nature in general, the second, children in particular, and the third, the role of international human rights instruments in constraining the worst aspects of our behavior and promoting, to quote Abraham Lincoln, the better angels of our nature. With respect to the first, I've just returned from a trip to Germany, notably to Berlin and to the restored towns and cities of the former German Democratic Republic, Dresden, Leipzig, Wittenberg, and Potsdam. For a person of my generation, this was a profoundly emotional experience, a visual reminder, on the one hand, of the horrors surrounding the Second World War, and on the other, the evidence of the remarkable resilience of people when the appropriate conditions are put in place, especially good governance, the rule of law shaped by international agreements, and adequate resources beginning with the Marshall Plan after the end of the war. So on the airplane on my way home, I read a book by an English author named Richard Holloway entitled Between Monster and Saint that effectively encapsulated my awareness, my renewed awareness, that all human beings are born with both the capacity to go in either direction, either towards the monster or towards the saint, and are driven, all of us, by profound, powerful emotional forces that are both sexual and aggressive. The one thing about getting old is that at least some of those forces diminish. Not the man in my the human task is to learn how to manage these tendencies that unbridled inflicts so much pain by both awareness and compassion. This is why respecting the human rights of children, according to the developmental principles of the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child, is so important. Another book I read on my trip was The Philosophical Bee by Alice, I'm sure that some young people I think may have read that one, by Dr. Alison Gopnik, who's a developmental psychologist at, I think, Berkeley, that confirmed my long-term observation of my own children and my children's children, that even very small babies theorize about the world around them and then constantly test their theories through action and interaction to construct a consistent worldview. Babies' minds are much more open than adults, and the pruning of our synapses in our brains through experience as we develop through time suggests that our potentialities diminish as we get older and our imaginations are gradually shuttered. I have a feeling as a parenthesis that one of the reasons that people have trouble respecting children to the degree that they should is that they've in fact lost their childishness and lost sometimes their capacity to understand or remember what it was like to be a child. So no wonder, I mean, I'm saying about the imagination being gradually shuttered, this is what I'm saying to you young people here, is that the most innovative period of human life actually is in your early 20s. Einstein, I mean, anyone who's produced a great new theory has usually been in that sort of age group before actually the categories get hardened by life experience. My mother used to say that she was getting older, you know, it's not the hardening of the arteries, it's actually the hardening of the categories. Anyone, you know, some of us are trying to avoid that as we get older, but you may have observed it in quite a lot of other people. So the degree to which the categories harden and which direction our tendencies are reinforced depends to a great deal on the social, cultural, economic, political, and legal environments with which children are surrounded. And all of you who've done child studies will recognize that basically is Bronfenbrenner's ecological model of human development. So what is the role of human rights instruments in helping children master the devils of their nature? In my view, the UN Declaration of Human Rights and all the instruments, covenants, conventions, and treaties that have evolved from it constitute the norms of social interaction that guarantee that the atrocious wrongs of the first part of the last century will never be repeated, at least not on a worldwide scale. And among the instruments, those instruments, the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child is one of the most important because it's been so rapidly and so widely ratified. So this is why the children at the UN Special Session on Children in 2002 declared, a world fit for children is a world fit for us all. But it's been said several times at the conference, transforming the state of conformity to a convention into compliance, to real compliance with its directives, is a very slow process. And governments have to be held accountable. So I'm now going to turn to the report that I co-authored with a colleague, Dr. Talmud Tara Collins, with respect to Canada's implementation of the general measures of the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child. The measures that altogether would create the architecture to respect, protect, and promote the rights of all children. Not surprisingly, we called it Not There Yet. This is available, this was published in Accenti and with UNICEF Canada, and it's available on UNICEF Canada's website. And it hopefully will be of interest to those of you who are following on these issues. The UN Committee, which is, I'm sure that this
group here is well acquainted with some of the processes related to conventions and so on and so forth, but you wouldn't be here. You know about the UN Committee on the Rights of the Child as being the instrument, as being the organization or the place that keeps is supposed to keep governments accountable through regular reporting from governments. So, and one of the things about the UN Committee that's been very impressive is the degree to which they built up a big body of jurisprudence, they call it jurisprudence, we call it jurisprudence, through the evaluation of the many, many reports that have come before them. Every country of the 193 states that have ratified the convention, which is virtually every state in the world except the United States, has appeared at least once before this committee with their reports, honest or otherwise, and have learned, the committee itself has learned through these many reports what are the cross-cutting issues, and have developed a number of principles which are not actually stated in the convention itself, but it would become the guiding principles by which we look at implementation of the Convention on the Rights of the Child. And so the reports, the general comments that the committee has developed over a number of years around the various issues are an extremely important part of the information that we need to use in order to keep governments accountable. The two that are most significant for me at this stage among the latest two, which is the one on the rights of the indigenous child, and the general comment on Article 12, which is the comment on youth child participation, the right to participate. And the reason those comments are significant, although we're not entirely sure whether governments actually read them, but they are written and addressed to the governments, all the signatories to the Convention on the Rights of the Child, as the guiding principles by which the government itself should evaluate its compliance with the convention. And for those of us working in the field, these are very significant pieces of work, because they are arrived at through a great deal of consultation, and Article 12 was actually arrived at through consultation with many people themselves, so that they would feel that they were part of the development of this general comment. The general measures of the convention is something else that the Committee on the Rights of the Child had developed. And these create the architecture. I think that term of what is the architecture for the protection, promotion, and respect for children's rights. The first is law reform. The second is budget allocation. So I was very, very interested in the discussion on budget allocation before to help to benefit children. We've tried to do some of that in this report, looking at both federal budgets and provincial budgets, and learning how to try to analyze them, and I'm going to look at that website and see if I can get some better way of doing it as benefits come out. When I was in the Senate, I did have the opportunity to look at estimates and budgets in the Finance Committee, and it's a very challenging process, disentangling what piece of that budget might benefit children and what piece is benefiting somebody else. That's law reform, budget allocation. The third one are national plans of action. In our report, we suggest that national plans of action in Canada are complicated and complex because of our federal system. And so it's better to talk about national strategies than to talk about national plans of action. We are not a country which is given to top-down design, and particularly provinces don't want to care for that, particularly this province. So a national strategy for action is what we recommend rather than a national plan. I was responsible after the special session on children to develop Canada's national plan of action in response to the special session, and it was a very large effort. It took us 2 years, involving a bunch of kids and a lot of other people, NGOs, civil society, government, so on and so forth. And I still think it's a very good plan, but getting the government to take it on and act it out has been much more challenging than I had anticipated, of course. In my years in the Senate, I was appointed by a different government than currently exists. So, I'll try not to be political. The fourth general measure are monitoring mechanisms. How kind of mechanisms have we established in the country to establish in order to monitor compliance? The fifth are child rights education, awareness raising, and training activities. Many people in the presentation so far have brought up the real importance of training, education, awareness, the need for people to understand what their rights are, to understand how to project the concepts of rights in a way that are acceptable to people who kind of resist the idea of children having rights, and so on. The sixth measure is an independent human rights institution for children, and I will speak to that briefly in a few minutes. Seventh are the our coordination efforts and collaboration on behalf of children, which are mechanisms that should be nourished and encouraged and so on. In my many years of working on issues related to children as well as women, it has struck me that the strongest structure in nature is a triangle. So you need, once upon a time in Canada, we had a Council for the Status of Women. We had Status of Women Canada inside government, a National Council, sort of an advisory position, and then we had the National Action Committee on the Status of Women. And that was 3-point, and each pressure presses on the others, and it was quite effective in many ways until the government decided to dismantle it. And I think some of us who've been in the women's movement for a long time feel that that has somewhat weakened the capacity to push ahead on women's rights. The eighth component, I had several general measures for implementation, but there is an eighth component that I insist on putting in, which is youth participation. And I'll speak a bit more to that in just a second. My time is limited, so I'm not going to go on, as I see, it's quite limited, but I think I can do less than 5 minutes. And so I wanted to share with you a few comments about the challenges to implementation of the Convention in Canada and the assets that we have in Canada and that many countries also have to address those challenges, and finally some recommendations. The challenges in Canada, I just mentioned, is the federal nature of our country does tend to make issues sometimes harder to push ahead. Public awareness, I think the two things that my colleague and I, Tara and I, concluded was there are two things that have to be changed before we can get real implementation. One is the raising of public awareness, and the other is political will. And those two things interact in a liberal democracy like ours, or any liberal democracy, whether it's constitutional or federal or parliamentary or whatever. Politicians respond to the pressures of the public, and if the public doesn't push on issues, then you don't get that much response on something that they feel might be difficult to get through, might go against their so-called political base. So public awareness is very, very important. In our budgetary analysis, we discovered there wasn't nearly enough money allocated to the raising of public awareness. Another issue has to do with the relations between civil society and federal government. Currently in Canada, we're in a position where civil society has been, parts of civil society, particularly those related to children, but others too, and others have mentioned that, is being weakened. And the relationship, in spite of the best intentions of earlier efforts to make the voluntary sector initiative agreement between government and civil society, there is some real severe problem. The role of the media has not been particularly helpful in promoting the rights of the children. That's another challenge. And support for youth participation is always problematic because it requires special effort on people's behalf, and people have to rethink and weigh what does it mean to ensure youth participation. When I was in the Senate, I made sure that every time we had a piece of legislation, such as the Youth Criminal Justice Act, where youth, young people were involved, that we brought with children as witnesses, young people as witnesses. It makes a huge difference, but there's no institutional structure to do that. So it depends much too much on individual leadership. The assets we have, the convention itself is a great asset. It's a remarkable document, which I'm sure could not be written today. I think we found it at the right time. The end, for me, was just after the fall of the Berlin Wall. So seeing the remnants of the Berlin Wall in Berlin made me realize the extraordinary opportunity that that window presented for human rights. And to some extent, 9/11 began to close that window. And we're into a period where human rights are under challenge. We have national assets. We have we're a good, I mean, we're often a well-off country. Our well-off country, well-governed, our government, our government structures are good. We have a lot of social, there's a lot going on in civil society. There's a lot of social innovation going on. Foundations and so on are doing some really, really interesting stuff. So it's not that we don't have assets to work with, but what are we going to do to keep our government? How can we be innovative? So we have 10 recommendations. I'll just go through them very quickly. First of all, we've got to promote the political will to implement the spirit and intent of the convention. Among everybody, you have to use that political will to establish an independent children's commissioner at the federal level of government. And we have a private member's bill by a local, I mean, here in Auckland, Montreal, to establish a children's commissioner, but he's number 200 on the list for private member's bill, so we're not holding our breath at the moment. I've tried for a number of years to get an independent children's commissioner, so it's not just current government. It's difficult to get governments to take this on. Federal government, provincial governments, there are 9 provincial advocates. The budget for resources has to be augmented. It has to, and we need particularly concerned with the Aboriginal population. We need to build more constructive working partnerships among different sectors. There's some good examples, but they need to be augmented. We have to do a lot of embedding the curriculum, UN Convention in the curriculum. And that's happening slowly. In Ontario, they're beginning to do something. This is known as teaching the new 3 R's, rights, respect, and responsibility. And I see the movement is in a positive direction, but it's very slow. We have to increase the numbers of professionals from all disciplines related to children who've been trained in the convention. There's more and more of that happening. It's a question of how long that will take to have an effect. We have to ensure that the existence of monitoring mechanisms at all levels of government and society, less to be critical than to uncover the problems and shortcomings in a timely manner so that decision makers can make the course corrections that they should make. We need to promote collaboration with the faith communities who are already predisposed towards social justice, many of them, and open to working with the most disadvantaged children and young people. And we need to engage the media as an ally and trying to get, there's some things in Canada working working with young people, like Taking It Global and so on, but we need to engage the media more. And most of all, in my view, we have to empower children and youth. They're the experts in their own lives, and the mechanisms that enable them to be heard are increasingly more sophisticated, thanks to the efforts of everyone working with the convention, and thanks to the evolution of the of the median. So persons between 10 and 19 years of age today form the largest generation the world has ever known, standing 1.2 billion strong. They are the very epicenter of change. Young people know the world has changed in ways unimaginable even 20 years ago when the Convention on the Rights of the Child was being drafted. They know they have access to new tools that many adults barely comprehend. They are, in fact, already becoming empowered by factors that are outside adult control. And the results are not always predictable. But one thing is certain, without the partnership of responsible adults with children in need as called for by the Convention on the Rights of the Child, neither Canada nor the world fit for children will ever be built.